I'm inventing a new religion.
Wow. Okay.
Right. That is literally the opening line of the document we're tearing into today. And I have to be honest, usually when a manifesto starts with a line like that, my first instinct is to just sort of check for a dateline from a bunker somewhere. It screams cult leader.
It really does. You kind of expect the very next sentence to be about, I don't know, aliens or a demand for wire transfers.
Yeah.
Or maybe a claim that they've discovered the secret to immortality.
Exactly. But this document, it's titled yournewreligion.pdf. It pulls a massive bait and switch right out of the gate. The author is a guy named Kevin Craig, and he claims that this quote-unquote new religion he is inventing is actually just the old one, specifically biblical Christianity.
But, and this is the crucial nuance here, it's a version of biblical Christianity that is so rigorous in its application that modern mainstream theologians look at it and say, well, that's not the faith we practice.
Right. His argument is basically, if the Pope, the Protestants, and the evangelicals all say I'm wrong, then logically I must be starting something entirely new. It's a pretty clever rhetorical trap. He's claiming to be so orthodox that he's somehow become a heretic.
Which is just a fascinating place to start a deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
Because we aren't just looking at theology here. We are looking at a radical restructuring of political and social reality. This text covers everything from why the U.S. dime is a symbol of fascism, to why voting might be a moral crime, to this sweeping vision of the world he calls vine and fig tree.
It is incredibly dense stuff. And just to orient you, listener, Kevin Craig isn't some random guy on a soapbox. I mean, he is on a soapbox, but he has a very specific background. He describes himself as a Bible-believing Christian who is actually excommunicated.
Yeah, and not for the usual reasons either. He wasn't kicked out for adultery or stealing church funds or denying the Trinity. He was excommunicated for his views on history and the state. So our mission today is really to figure out what this new religion is, why he thinks the rest of us are unknowingly in a cult, and whether his logic actually holds up.
Let's start with the foundation. Because if you are going to claim you have a new religion, you obviously need a definition of religion. And he doesn't use the standard, you know, belief in a higher power dictionary definition.
No, he digs quite a bit deeper. He cites Paul Tillich, the famous Harvard theologian, who defined religion simply as a person's ultimate concern.
Ultimate concern. That sounds a little philosophical. How does he ground that?
It's actually very practical when you unpack it. It democratizes the entire concept of religion. It means you don't have to go to a temple or a church to be religious. Your religion is just whatever dominates your mind, whatever you are most concerned with, whatever you look to for security, meaning, or salvation.
So for the guy who spends 80 hours a week climbing the corporate ladder,
his career is his religion.
Precisely. Or politics. Or, to use a really modern example, if you spend 6 hours a day playing video games and that is where you derive your total sense of achievement, that is your liturgy. That is your ultimate concern.
And Craig uses this framework to categorize people into two main camps. He talks about the dud versus the extremist. And I have to say, the description of the dud felt almost like a personal attack on half the population.
It is harsh, but it's a very specific spiritual critique. The dud is the person with no ultimate concern. They are just lukewarm. They work, they consume entertainment, they sleep, they repeat. Craig actually links this to the book of Revelation, specifically the letter to the Laodiceans, where Jesus says, "I would that you were cold or hot, so then because you are lukewarm, I will spit you out of my mouth."
So in this framework, apathy isn't just a personality trait. It's a massive spiritual danger zone.
Right. Being a dud is offensive to the creator because it completely lacks passion or purpose. But then on the flip side, you have the extremists. And you can be an extremist for a false religion, like power or money, or an extremist for the true religion.
And this is where we really have to clarify what he means by true religion, because he's not talking about memorizing creeds or singing hymns. He points to one very specific verse, James 1.27.
Pure religion and undefiled is to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction.
Okay, so standard charity. Feed the poor. Take care of people. Most people, religious or not, would agree with that.
But Craig does something really interesting here. He essentially weaponizes that verse. He turns it into a litmus test for entire political systems. He argues that if pure religion is caring for widows and orphans, then any system that systematically creates widows and orphans must inherently be a false religion.
Oh, I see the pivot. He's moving from individual ethics to a massive systemic critique. He's talking about war.
War, policing, state violence, all of it. His logic is that you cannot claim to practice the true religion of caring for victims while you simultaneously support the machinery that creates them. If your ultimate concern, say, your patriotism or your political party requires bombing fathers and killing husbands, you are actively practicing a false religion.
That is a remarkably hard line to draw. He's basically saying you can't outsource your morality to the government. If the government kills and you support the government, you are a working part of that mechanism.
And that uncompromising stance is exactly what got him into so much trouble. Which brings us to the personal conflict in the document. This wasn't just abstract theory for Craig. He lost his entire community over this.
Well, let's unpack that excommunication story, because it involves a clash between two very different, very intense theological worldviews.
It really does. So Craig started out deeply influenced by Christian Reconstructionism. This is a movement largely associated with a thinker named R.J. Rushdoony. The core belief is that biblical law should govern all of society, not just your personal morality, but civil law, courts, economics, everything.
So they want a Bible-based society. And usually, historically anyway, that implies a strong state enforcing those laws, right?
Traditionally, yes. Reconstructionists are often viewed as very law and order focused. They want the civil magistrate to enforce righteousness. But Craig started drifting toward Anabaptist views.
Anabaptists. Like the Mennonites or the Amish.
Yeah.
Groups that are famous for absolute pacifism and a strict separation from the state.
Exactly. So imagine the ideological collision happening inside his head. On one hand, he believes the Bible should apply to absolutely everything, which is the Reconstructionist side. On the other hand, he believes the Bible strictly forbids all violence, which is the Anabaptist side. And he tries to merge these two.
A pacifist who wants biblical law to rule the world. That is a truly unique combination.
It really is. And it led to a massive conflict with his mentor, a very well-known theologian named Greg Bahnsen. Craig ended up being excommunicated. And the reason he gives in the text, he claims it was for using the F word.
I'm guessing not the four-letter one?
No. The word was fascist.
He called the leaders of the Protestant Reformation, guys like Ulrich Zwingli, who are absolute heroes to Presbyterians, he called them fascists.
And that was the breaking point. The church leadership essentially said, "You are slandering the brethren. Recant or leave." Craig refused. He argued that he was just being historically accurate.
But is he? I mean, calling a 16th century theologian a fascist seems like a pretty extreme case of anachronistic name calling.
Well, let's look at the evidence he presents. He points out that Zwingli didn't just preach sermons. He held real political power. And he used the sword of the state to hunt down Anabaptists simply because they disagreed with him on theology like adult baptism. He literally had them drowned. He also used economic sanctions, blocking salt and wheat shipments to starve Catholic regions into submission.
Starving people to make them agree with your theology. Okay, that is undeniably brutal.
Craig looks at that history and asks, what do we call a system where the leader uses violence and economic strangulation to enforce a specific ideology? He calls it fascism. He argues that Zwingli was a proto-fascist.
And he connects this to J. Gresham Machen, which is interesting because I know Machen's a huge figure in conservative theological circles.
He is. Back in the 1920s, Machen famously argued that liberal Christianity, the kind that denied miracles and the supernatural, wasn't just a different flavor of Christianity. He said it was a completely different religion altogether. Craig uses that exact same logic. He says statism, the belief that we need violence and government affairs to solve social problems, is also a completely different religion.
So if you trust the sword more than you trust God's law of peace, you have officially swapped religions.
Exactly. You are worshiping the state. And this isn't just an abstract theological concept for him. Craig brings this right down to the literal pocket change in your wallet. He talks about the U.S. dime.
This part of the source material completely blew my mind. The Mercury dime.
Right. It's a specific coin design used in the early 20th century. If you look at the back of a Mercury dime, you see a bundle of wooden rods with an axe head sticking out at the top.
I've seen that symbol. It's actually on the wall of the U.S. House of Representatives, too, flanking the main podium.
It is. That symbol is called the fasces. It's an ancient Roman emblem. The bundle of rods represents unity, the idea that we are stronger together, but the axe. The axe represents the magistrate's absolute authority to punish and execute. It is the ultimate symbol of state power and violence.
And that is literally where the word fascism comes from, the fasces.
Correct. So when Craig calls the U.S. government or the reformers fascist, he isn't just throwing around an insult the way people do on the internet today. He is making a structural argument. He's saying that any entity that claims a monopoly on that axe, the exclusive right to initiate violence to enforce its will, is structurally fascist.
So it doesn't matter if it's a representative democracy or a totalitarian dictatorship. if the core mechanism operating underneath is do what we say or we use the axe, it's a fascist structure in his view.
And he claims this structure is the ultimate false religion. It demands your money through taxation, and it demands your life through war. He explicitly calls taxation extortion and war mass murder.
He certainly doesn't mince words. He says the state essentially claims an exemption from God's law. God says, thou shalt not steal, but the state says taxation is legal. God says, thou shalt not kill. The state says war is legal.
And that builds right up to his concept of the zone of lawlessness, which is arguably the intellectual climax of the whole manifesto. But before we get there, we really need to look at his alternative. Because he isn't just tearing everything down. He outlines a very specific vision he calls vine and fig tree.
It sounds incredibly pleasant.
Right.
Very pastoral and agrarian.
It comes straight from the prophet Micah, chapter 4. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, neither shall they learn war anymore. And then verse 4 says, but they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid.
It's the ultimate biblical vision of peace. But here is the rub. Most Christians who read that believe it's a prophecy for heaven, or maybe for the very end of time when Jesus comes back. They definitely don't see it as a viable policy proposal for the modern world.
And this is where Craig pulls out a very heavy theological tool called anarcho-preterism.
Okay, we definitely need to break that term down, starting with preterism.
It comes from the Latin word for past. Preterism is the theological belief that the last days prophecies in the Bible, the apocalyptic stuff in Matthew 24 or the book of Revelation, were not actually about the end of the physical planet. They were about the end of the old covenant system, specifically the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in the year AD 70.
So when the Bible talks about how the end is near, a preterist looks at that and says, yes, it was near to them. It already happened 2,000 years ago.
Right. Now think about the massive real-world implication of that. If the last days are already over, that means the kingdom of God has already been established. It means the Messiah is reigning right now.
Oh, say where this is going. If the kingdom is happening right now, then we can't just sit around waiting for the future to beat our swords into plowshares. We have to do it right now.
Exactly. You can't just wave it off and say, oh, I'll stop supporting war when Jesus comes back. Craig argues Jesus is already king. Therefore, Christians are ethically obligated to dismantle the war machine today. They are obligated to completely abolish the public sector, which he views purely as the realm of the sword, and move everything into the private sector.
He uses a really helpful distinction here from the sociologist Franz Oppenheimer. The difference between political man and economic man.
It's a crucial distinction for grasping his worldview. Oppenheimer argued that there are basically only two ways to get what you want in life, the political means and the economic means.
The political means is essentially just taking it.
Right. It's the method of the archist, the ruler. If I want your money, I tax you. If I want your land, I conquer you. It completely relies on coercion and force.
And the economic means.
That is the method of the plowshare. If I want your money, I have to offer you a good or a service that you actually value. I have to trade with you. I have to persuade you. It relies entirely on voluntary cooperation.
So the vine and fig tree vision is a world populated purely by economic man, a world without a public sector because the public sector is inherently coercive.
Yes. He views the private sector not as some sort of greedy capitalist dystopia, but as the actual manifestation of the kingdom of God.
Right.
Because it is the only realm where human relations are entirely voluntary and peaceful.
Which logically leads us to the part of the document that will probably upset the most people. He argues that the act of voting is a sin.
It follows his logic perfectly, even if it feels incredibly jarring to hear. If the state is an engine of violence, if it uses the axe to create widows and orphans, then voting for a politician to operate that engine is directly participating in the crime.
He uses the hitman analogy to make this point.
He does. He asks a very direct question. If you hire a hitman to kill your neighbor, are you guilty of murder?
Well, legally and morally, yes, of course.
Okay. So his follow-up is, if you vote for a president knowing full well that he will bomb a village in a foreign country and kill civilians, aren't you essentially just hiring a hitman on a massive scale?
Most people listening to that would immediately argue, no, I'm voting for the lesser of two evils, or I'm voting to maintain stability and order.
And Craig explicitly calls that the heresy of democracy. He argues that we have developed the shared delusion that a majority vote can somehow sanitize a sin. That if 51% of the population agrees to take your money or kill a foreigner, it magically transforms into justice. He says, no, it's just mob violence with better PR.
It is a radical insistence on individual responsibility. He frames this whole battle as capitalism versus socialism, but he defines those terms religiously, not just economically.
This might be one of his most interesting insights. He defines socialism as political deism.
Political deism. Let's unpack that.
So classical deism is the belief that God created the world like a clockmaker, wound it up, and then walked away. He doesn't intervene. He doesn't provide for us. Craig argues that socialists, and really anyone who relies heavily on the state, are acting exactly like deists. They don't genuinely believe God will provide for society through natural providence or voluntary charity. They think the world will literally collapse into chaos without a strong government hand forcing it to work.
So because they lack faith in God's providence, they feel forced to play God themselves.
Exactly. They have to use the state to save society. Whereas he views laissez-faire capitalism, meaning true 100% free markets, as a profound system of faith. It's the belief that if we simply follow God's ethical rules, don't steal, don't kill, and just serve one another, that God will bless that. That beautiful order will emerge naturally from liberty, not from top-down control.
The customer is king. He uses that phrase quite a bit in the text.
He practically elevates it to a theological statement. Serving the customer is serving your neighbor. It is the exact opposite of ruling over your neighbor with a sword.
But he freely admits this is heresy to most people. He knows the mainstream church looks at this, calls it anarchism, and completely rejects it.
He totally embraces the outsider status. He quotes Acts 24.14, where the Apostle Paul says, "After the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers." Craig sees himself right in that lineage. He believes the modern church has sold out to the archists, the state worshipers, just like the religious leaders of Paul's day sold out to Rome.
It really brings us back to that core challenge we teased earlier, the zone of lawlessness. I think this is the concept that lingers the longest after you finish reading the text.
It really is the linchpin of his whole argument. Craig argues that most of us carve out a massive mental exception in our ethics. We believe the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," applies to me and you perfectly. If I walk into your house and take your TV, that's theft. If I shoot you, that's murder.
But we create a completely separate zone for the government.
Right. We create a zone of lawlessness where the moral laws of the universe are magically suspended. Inside that zone, theft is suddenly called taxation. Kidnapping is called conscription. Murder is called foreign policy.
We just change the vocabulary to hide the grim reality of what's happening.
Exactly. But Craig challenges you, the listener, with a brutally simple theological question. Does God have a zone of lawlessness? Is there any square inch of God's creation where his command, "Thou shalt not kill," is suspended simply because someone happens to be wearing a badge or standing behind a podium?
And if your answer to that is no?
If the answer is no, then the new religion is simply the demand to remove that exception from your mind, to live consistently, to stop outsourcing violence to the state and calling it justice.
It's a terrifying thought, honestly. Because if he is right about this, then almost everything we do politically is an active form of rebellion.
It forces you to take a very hard look in the mirror. You don't have to agree with his interpretation of the Mercury Dime or his preterist theology to feel the profound weight of that question. Are we carving out moral exemptions for violence just because it makes our lives more convenient?
And are we comfortably calling ourselves religious while supporting a system that does the exact opposite of what our religion actually commands?
That is the dud life again. Being lukewarm. Craig wants you to be hot or cold. You have to make a choice. Is your ultimate concern the sword or is it the vine?
It's a lot to process. The document is your new religion.pdf, and whether you convert to his way of thinking or not, it definitely makes you question the old one.
That is the goal of any good manifesto, to shake the foundations.
Absolutely.
So to you listening, when you look at your own life, what is your ultimate concern? And if you decided to beat your sword into a plowshare today, would you be a saint or a traitor?
Maybe a little bit both.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll catch you on the next one.